Bring me up to date on what you've been doing over the past year.
Well, I've been working on another book, and actually, it's quite an interesting book. It started as a nonfiction book. I wanted to write a profile of a doctor. I thought that would be interesting. My experiences with my father being sick got me very interested in doctors and how they work and what's going on with doctors. And of course, there's all this brouhaha now about doctors being so inhuman and doctors not treating patients well. And indeed, with my father, we had a couple of really appalling doctors, you know, doctors who clearly had no interest in him as a man, were only interested in him as a case, and that was very painful for us. So I decided I wanted to write a profile of a doctor at Sloan Kettering. And I went to Sloan Kettering, I interviewed a lot of doctors, and I started to follow a couple doctors around. They gave me a white coat, which was interesting, and I actually watched these guys work, and it was fascinating. I mean, to see the other side, you know, when you've been a patient, to see how it works on the other side, and to be able to be compassionate for the other side, which I had not been able to do, was just, I hate to use a cliche like an eye-opener, but it was just fascinating for me. I mean, I would spend 8 hours inside the hospital, it would seem like 5 minutes. And so I decided to profile one of these guys, and I started working on it. And the profile just took off and turned into a novel, because the thing about them, you know, it would have been very interesting. A profile would have been very interesting, but what the practice of medicine, particularly dealing with cancer, does to their lives is just fascinating. How they handle it, you know, how they balance their families and their own children, you know, with these patients. And I mean, not all cancer patients die, of course, but half of them do. And you know, it's at Sloan Kettering, you have a very sophisticated level of patient and a very sophisticated doctor, and it just got more and more interesting. So, as I said, it sort of turned into a novel quite spontaneously, and that's what I'm working on.
I remember the last time you were here and we were talking about your father's death, you were very angry over the way his treatment was handled, and in fact, this was going to be a nonfiction reporter, you told me then, that dealt with cancer, and specifically with the medical profession, and I think specifically with one doctor, right?
You felt mishandled
the case.
Well, I wasn't. The doctor who I thought mishandled the case, and of course there were many doctors involved, wasn't the doctor I was going to profile. Of course, he wouldn't have let me profile him. The doctor I was going to profile, I hoped... that it would be a sympathetic profile. In other words, what I hoped to do was to find a doctor who I could sort of make into a hero, because in a way I had a very romantic view of Sloan Kettering. I mean, here are these guys. They don't make a lot of money. They work longer hours than any of us. I mean, they literally work 20-hour days. They've trained themselves to sleep very little. They have no family lives, no outside lives. I mean, they really are dedicated to their work in a way that most of us have no idea about. You know, we all think we work hard, but most of us go home by 9 or 10 at night. We really do. And I thought, and what are they getting for it? You know, nothing but the personal satisfaction of helping some people. So I had a very romantic view of Sloan Kettering. And I still do in a way. But I originally thought it would be a profile, you know, kind of the last hero, you know, this doctor. I forget when I talked to you. I certainly was angry over the way my father was handled. But I wanted to write a very positive book. I wanted the profile to be a positive profile. And I still have positive feelings about these doctors, but it's much more complicated than that, you know. It isn't just sort of one doctor silhouetted against the sky. It's really complicated. And often what they give to their patients, they take from their families, you know. Often the way you have to deal with it when you have a job like that, it changes the personality. You know, it's hard to say if these doctors start this way and that's why they get into those jobs, or if they change once they get into the jobs. But they're different from you and me. I mean, it changes them in ways that are just fascinating, because I'm fascinated by human behavior, of course.
Are you still working on the novel?
Yeah, it's about half done.
Why is it that there seems to be an enormous difference in the way people approach novels and the time they spend on them? I was reading somewhere that Hugh Nissen spent 5 years working on his novel. It's a very short novel.
Yeah.
And other people Well, John Fowles was here a few weeks ago, and he was telling me that he wrote The Collector in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
5 years, 3 weeks? What does this mean?
Well, it's interesting about fiction. There's so many interesting things to be said about the writing of fiction. When I first wrote Looking for Work, and, you know, I hate, writers hate to admit these things because they're afraid that people will misunderstand. As you'll see, I wrote Looking for Work in about 6 weeks, and I couldn't believe I was doing it because I knew that it took years to write a novel. And nevertheless, here were these finished pages day after day after day. And what happened was I got obsessed with Looking for Work. I didn't sleep. I didn't talk about anything else. But it didn't take very long. And I was terribly upset because I knew if it only took 6 weeks, it couldn't be a novel. And I started counting pages in other people's books.
Or a very good novel.
Right. Well, I knew it couldn't be a novel at all. And since then, I've learned that many people write that quickly, more quickly. Stendhal wrote The Charterhouse of Parma in 6 weeks, and that's a big, complicated book. But people I know write that quickly. But people don't like to talk about that because they're afraid that their reading public will think, oh, well, it's easy. You know, and the fact is, I had a really interesting experience about this. I usually only work in the morning. I mean, my working day is not very long. And I'll go to work about 9 o'clock in the morning, and by 1 o'clock, I'm through. You know, maybe in the afternoon, I'll write letters or something. But I decided at one point in my career, someone offered me a teaching job, right, 2 afternoons a week. And I thought, absolutely, I'm not doing anything in the afternoon. So I blithely took this teaching job, and I found that I couldn't write. And what I learned from that was that those hours when I'm not writing are crucial to the hours when I am. And I need 3 or 4 or 5 hours a day to sort of collect myself. And I'm all that time when I think I'm doing other things, you know, shopping or sweeping the floor or whatever it is, reading, I'm actually, process is such a vogue word now, but I'm actually doing some kind of thinking which is critical to what happens when I sit down at the typewriter. And I think the same thing is true with bigger blocks of time. In other words, Looking for Work took me such a short time because I had spent years thinking about it, almost without knowing I was thinking about it. So I think it just, you know, the amount of time a novel takes depends on how you happen to have approached it. This novel that I'm writing now could take 4 or 5 years. And I'm the same writer that wrote a novel in 6 weeks, you know, because I approached it. It's had a long evolution. I obviously wasn't thinking about it when I was writing Home Before Dark. I didn't even start thinking about it until about, what, 8 months ago? Or year and a half ago. Well, when did Home Before Dark come out? Well, till quite recently. So I've had to do all the research and the thought and the laying of the ground, and that can take a long time. So it varies wildly. But I think one thing that writers don't tell you, and that really I know caused me a great deal of agony, is it doesn't matter how long it takes, and it doesn't matter how long your working day is. Every writer does it differently. You know, a writer's life, you can't say this too often, a writer's life is an improvisation. There is no should. You know, writing is so difficult, you have to do it however you can do it.
Well, it matters to a full-time professional writer such as Evan Hunter, who's a much better writer than he's given credit for, but he can easily turn out 3 novels, 4 novels a year. What he normally tries to do is to write what he calls a serious novel every 2 years, and then 2 or 3 novels under the name Ed McBain.
Right.
The rest of the time. But he says, look, you're sitting there at your typewriter, and you got to start putting the keys to work, and at the end of the day, you've turned out X number of pages. He says, well, what else do you do?
Yeah, well, sometimes it varies.
Besides
know?
That, he needs the he, right, that's his bread know. And butter. But he doesn't teach. He doesn't have any other kind of work. He has to survive, or he does survive, exclusively on the things he writes.
Yeah, well, I don't think for the first 4 years of my career, I wrote a book a year with no trouble at all. Actually, I wrote 2 books in the first year, and a page a day is not very much, and that's really a novel a year or more. It's a big novel a year.
But you can't really write that. People say that. You know, you write a page a day, at the end of the year you have a novel. But who can sit there and write a page a day?
Well, no, you don't. You write 10 pages a day.
Yeah, well, whatever. One page a day or 10 pages a day, but you don't write it. You don't think, I don't believe, in terms of pages. You
think
in
terms of ideas and thoughts. No, but what I'm saying is, if you go to work every day, and if you don't have any research to do, and, I hate to say this because it takes some writers years, but I'll write about 10 drafts. It takes me about a month to write a first draft. And then I'll write about 10 drafts, some more in some areas of the book that I think need it. So I could write 20 drafts. I could write, it just depends on where you're willing to stop. But it does vary. It does vary. Because this novel that I'm writing now took me, I spent 4 months really doing research. And then I spent about 6 months really writing it as a profile. And about 6 months ago, or more recently, beginning of the summer, I started writing it as a novel, and now I'm halfway through it. So, each book is different, and each writer is different. That's the thing I can't say enough. I mean, so many young people who want to be writers say to me, well, don't you have to go to your typewriter every day, and isn't it wrong for a writer to do such and such, and do you think that I can take this job and still be a writer? And the answer is, who knows? Everybody has to figure that out for themselves, and there is no, particular way to live, or, can a writer live in the city? Can a writer wear a blue suit? I mean, these things are not relevant to the life of a writer, which has to be forged individually. So, does that answer your question?
It does.
Okay.
Home Before Dark appeared in 1984. It's now 1985, and it's out now as a pocketbook. So you've had, so a lot of the water has flowed under the bridge since the book first came out. I just wonder if you've had any second thoughts about your very candid profile of your father since the time it first came out.
Well, I certainly haven't had second thoughts. No, I think the answer is no. Every day, I'm happier that I did it the way I did it. I'm so glad that almost everything in my father's life, the good and the bad, is at least on paper in a way that I consider to be sympathetic. Because more and more I see the dangers of other people writing about him and gossiping about him or whatever. And I'm so happy that I was able to tell his story in a sympathetic, loving way before anyone else got to it.
Well, you wrote, of course, about your father's apparent homosexuality or bisexuality. You wrote about his alcoholism. You wrote about his terrible struggle with cancer. And I wonder, having put all of these thoughts so dramatically on paper, if you've had any recriminations from people who also loved your father, maybe readers or people who knew him, but who were shocked. What kind of fallout did you have from the book?
Well, it was interesting, and it's hard to separate what people actually think from what the media leads them to think. But there certainly was controversy, and I think a lot of it was whipped up. What happened with my family, my immediate family, my mother and my two brothers, was when I first finished the book, the manuscript, 8 months before it came out, I sent it to each of them, Federal Express, at the same moment, saying, please tell me what you'd like me to change. Please tell me what you'd like me to do. And my mother had about 53 factual inaccuracies that she thought I should change. My brother wanted some structural changes. My other brother thought it was perfect the way it was. So I made most of those changes, both that my mother asked for and my brother asked for, because I certainly didn't want to offend anyone in the family. And then, after the book came out, the press, I don't know, having been a journalist, I don't want to say that they wanted to make copy of it, but they did call my mother and my brothers and ask them questions like, weren't you upset at such and such a passage, right? And that created quite a lot of dissension, not in the family, but they also called some neighbors who had some, I think people who were very, my father projected a very strong image, although it was indeed facade, and even he knew that, an image of a kind of peaceful country squire. And to some people, it was terribly important that he be that image. To some people, not people who'd been close to him, I think, but people who had known him in a casual way, neighbors, you know, friends, because he was famous, it really was important to them that he be what he in fact wasn't. And I think those people were not pleased at all by the book, because in a sense, I think they felt, I'm not sure what they felt, but I think they felt it reflected on them. In other words, if this guy, this sort of wealthy country squire who they could claim as a friend, turned out to be a human being with agonies and imperfections and secret lives just like the rest of us, then it wasn't so enhancing for them. So some people did react very badly, or not very badly, but some people weren't pleased. But on the other hand, I had the most tremendous response from readers. I've gotten about 500 letters, and I'm still getting about 2 or 3 letters a week from people who say, you know, this is an incredible story. You've told my story. I mean, people identify with this so much in a way they could never have identified with some country squire, right? I mean, clearly most people do have difficulties in their lives. And this outpouring of letters from all over the country has just been tremendous. And I don't, pleasing is the wrong word, but I love it.
Do you try to answer them?
Yeah, I try to answer them. I answered them all until about 2 months ago, and now they've built up again. But I really want to answer them all. I really want to, because I feel that those are my readers, you know. Those are the people who are supporting me. Those are the people who are enabling me to write what I write. I mean, the people who buy the books are, you know.
I know.
Rather than the editors or the publishers are the people owe everything to.
The interference that the news media gave you and your family by questioning them about whether or not they were offended and so forth, that didn't cause any lasting damage, did it?
In the family? Mm-hmm. Or No. In fact, the way I found out about it was that there was a story in the Times, and before I had opened the paper, my brother and my mother both called to apologize and say they hoped I wasn't angry. So I was much more worried than, you know, the story, what they said and what they had told the reporter wasn't that bad, but they were both very worried that it would cause dissension in the family. So it didn't, no, it didn't at all.
Will there be more material written by John Schieffer that might be posthumously published, letters, for example?
Yes, my brother Ben is working on a volume of the letters, which I think will be a fabulous book. I mean, my father was he cared so much what other people thought of him, in a good way, you know. And as a result, his letters were wonderful. And I think my brother will, in a way, write his own Home Before Dark in collecting the letters. And I think that he'll write an introduction and also write, you know, things in between the letters. Because there are a lot of cases where, you know, an incident will happen. You know, he'll get a prize or something. And he'll write 5 different versions of the incident, you see, to 5, a sort of submissive letter to his editor and a kind of letter telling how he really knocked their heads together to a friend of his. And so I think my brother, you know, will be able to get into all that and really tell the story in his own way. And I think that's going to be a wonderful book. And we're also, I think, getting ready to publish the journals.
That's right. He kept a daily journal.
You
used that extensively, didn't you?
Yeah, I used it extensively, but I used a fraction of a fraction of it. It's about 1 million words. It's 30 typewritten volumes.
Now, who's editing that?
Well, I think us three children will edit it.
You have not started that project yet.
We have not started that yet. We've just begun to think about it.
Actually. Is there any unpublished fiction that John Schieffer left behind?
No, there isn't. There isn't.
He was a very spare writer, wasn't he?
Yeah, the journals are fiction in a way. I mean, the journals are, they'll make a wonderful narrative, you know, because it's really the story of his life as he told it. And he was, it's beautifully written, you know. In a way, it's funny not to denigrate his published writing, but his journals and his letters to some extent are in a way more compelling than his published writing.
John Schieffer suggested to you that you keep a journal, and I believe you did. Are you still doing it?
I try to. Boy, I am not, I don't want to say I'm not disciplined, but I have, you know, I have a 3-year-old child. I have, I have my work, and I live in the city, which, of course, is very distracting. And I don't think I've made a journal entry for about 4 months. So it varies, I guess, is the right answer.
Well, you'll be able to, when you read Hugh Nissenson's book, you'll be able to catch up on a journal. He kept his for a whole year.
Yeah, well, I think a journal is a wonderful form. You know, it really...
Well, when I was a kid, every year or so, someone would give me a diary. Using one of those little diaries that had a little flap and a little lock on it.
Right,
it would never work. And I'd usually keep... I guess I didn't know what to expect or what I should do, but I would keep a journal for about 2 days.
Then give it up.
Then the diary would inevitably be thrown out.
Well, you know, it's interesting about journals. When I was a kid, when I was 16, 17, 18, I thought I was going to, before I gave up the idea of being a writer, I kept copious journals. And they were terrible because I didn't understand that journals aren't about your feelings. They're about what happens to you. And if you just sit down, this is certainly true of me, if I just sit down every day and write what happened to me, not what I feel about it, but what happened to me, it's so interesting. Just historically.
That's exactly.
I mean, you can't miss.
Well, you know, one thing that can kind of take the form of journal, I don't know if you'd use it, but I have so many functions, so many people I interview a week, so many things to do, so many meetings, so many of this and that, that I have one of these calendar books. You
know, right.
You buy it at a stationery store or Barnes & Noble, and I make entries, even if it's like... don't forget to take shirts to laundry.
Right.
You know, I know that on a given day I've done that. My handwriting is terrible, but I can at least flip through there. And I've kept this up in a detailed way because I need it. So I know what I'm going to do tomorrow.
Right.
But I've just held on to these things, and I've looked back. They've been very helpful. For example, I was reconstructing a bunch of the interviews that I did so that I could go through them and put them on cassette tape and also file them at home so I can drag them out, pull them out when I need them. And this is of historical interest to me because I do retrospectives of writers. And also for when John Cheever died, for example, I had an interview with John Cheever, which I lost, could not find it. I did not have my original interview with John Cheever. It's something that I should have had because on his death I should have done a story on him other than what I did, which had no sound or anything, but I should have been able to use his voice. So having these daily calendars... enables me to flip back and find the date that I've done things. It's been a big help. Do you do something like that? Because that can almost take the place.
Well, I have that, but what you remind me of is my father said that he kept a journal and his father kept a journal because they were all sailors and they kept a logbook.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's in a logbook. Don't forget to take shirts to the laundry. Wind from the northeast, you know, gusting into the sails, beans for dinner. And the thing is, if you put three sentences together, you know, wind from the northeast or don't forget to take shirts to the laundry, you know, accosted by a blonde woman at the corner of 89th Street, chicken for dinner. It's interesting.
Not only that, it sparks the memory.
Well,
I mean, you are carrying
you,
it like
it
a computer.
Sparks, but what I'm saying is even for another person to read,
yeah,
it's interesting.
But if you want to write about it, it would seem to me that this attack by a blonde woman on the corner of 86th Street,
it
this
comes
will
back,
bring
right.
the memory of it back.
But in a way, you see, in order to write about it, you have to be a writer. What I'm saying is if you just keep the log, that makes good reading. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
if
I'm going to show you mine, and I'm going to ask you if you think it's going to be of interest to you,
right.
Especially about the
movie.
Shirts. Besides
well,
that.
You know, these ship's logs that these old guys kept are really good reading, and that's exactly what they are. But they're of, you know, it's fascinating historically to read the log of some ship crossing to China, you know, in the early 19th century. And that's what they're writing. I mean, they had no thought of writing. No. And in a way, it's much more eloquent. I mean, so much of writing goes overboard about feelings. But if you read a ship's log that says, you know, wind from the northeast, porpoises to starboard, you know, today, and it says, you know, homesickness, right? Just one word, right? And then it says landed at such and such an island and traded, you know, beads for dishes or whatever. That one word is so much more eloquent than if the guy had said, oh, gee, I feel terrible. I really miss my kids.
That is exactly what Hugh Nissenson has done. If you just look through it, you'll see exactly that without
any
emotion.
It's this thing of the objective correlative. I mean, you have to find ways to put your feelings into objects.
But the fact that you have made these lists, if you have encountered something so horrible, whether it's on a ship or fighting Indians,
right.
And you stated in a matter-of-fact way, eventually the horror of this builds
right.
without your having to say it's horrible.
Right, exactly.
If you say that women's breasts were taken off and then used by the Indians to store musket pellets or whatever they
right.
used, something like that, the horror of that act,
right.
you don't... The writer doesn't have to
right.
say it's horrible.
Exactly.
I mean, you
exactly.
know it.
Well, and ideally, everything you write should have that power. In other words, the writer should never have to tell the reader.
Yeah, sure.
that it's horrible or wonderful
but,
or fabulous.
But in writing, though, it's easy sometimes. For mystery novels are this way. They usually tell you everything you have to know. They will give a lot of adjectives
right.
and tell you everything you have to know and give you reminders
right.
about a person is reintroduced in the book and his title or her
right.
title and whatever. And this makes it easy, especially for someone like myself. I read very fast.
Right.
And so it's very easy because this tells me everything I have to know very quickly. And if the author is telling me about what the weather is like, he'll go into great detail about it's pouring down rain and all that. But a really good writer won't do that. It's not
no,
necessary to
exactly.
do it, but he makes you
well,
work
it's
and
old,
think.
Well, it's this old rule, show, don't tell. You know, it's the cardinal rule. It's what they teach you in freshman composition.
But that it makes for a slower read because it makes more demands on the reader.
No, it's less demands on the reader because the reader is able to feel those same feelings without even having to think about what the feelings are. In other words, if I write a book and it says, he felt wonderful, you have to say to yourself, well, okay, when have I felt wonderful? I mean, this is all subconscious. You have to plug into that, they felt wonderful. But if I write it and I say, you know, there he sat in his radio studio and from the ceiling came whatever it is that would make you feel, you don't even have to go through that process. You just, in identification with the character, also feel wonderful.
Well, I don't agree with you that makes... I do believe that puts additional demands because the reader must interpret these scenes, whereas in a piece of hack writing, like
they
a mystery or the kind of thing I write,
well,
all of the code words are there for you. They're all spelled out,
them,
and you don't have to think.
If you have to interpret them, they're not right. You know, they should. You know, what you aim for in writing is universality, right?
But writing is a matter of interpretation because you look at a sentence. John Fowles told me this when he was here a couple of weeks ago. He says, I don't tell you everything that you need to know when I write a novel. He says, I know this is not popular in America. I'm quoting him. He says, but I leave out things, and I put demands on the reader to look at a line and figure it out.
Well, I think he's, particularly in his case, I think he's underestimating himself. I think, you know, what he's saying is that if you make it harder for the reader, you engage the reader more, of course. You know, you get you demand more engagement from the reader. But I think that if it's done right, as he certainly does it right, it's less work because you don't have to say, I mean, wonderful doesn't tell you very much. Right?
No, but it... But that's all right. It's a code word. It gives the reader an idea of what
well,
the
right.
person
but
is
I think,
doing without
I
having
think
to think about
have,
it.
Well, right. But I think you can have a sentence which I can't compose on the spot, which means wonderful, which universally evokes wonderful, even without the reader having to think, oh, wonderful, you know. I don't agree. I think good writing makes the reader work less hard.
Well, Susan Cheever, we could bat this around for the next several
right.
hours, and here you thought we wouldn't have anything to say to each other. We've been talking for 45 minutes. I'm delighted that Home Before Dark is out on paperback now because when I read it last year, I found it a very heartwarming and moving experience, and I admired your father's work so much. I have all of his books except for the very first one, which I'm still looking for, although the stories have been collected, but I'd like to find the book at some point, and I've been poking around looking for it, and so I admire that. And I also admire your work, and I'm anxious to catch up on the trilogy, your trilogy. I thought Looking for Work was terrific, absolutely terrific. I assume there are some autobiographical ramifications to it, and which is usually the case in writing. I'm particularly anxious to read your new book, and I'll be looking for that when it comes out, and I hope that I'll be able to have you back and we'll chat about that.
Great. Okay.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.